And so he takes the advantage. He starts on Saturday and just kind of keeps on teaching all the way into the night. And there was disruptions there too, just like we've had this morning. At one point he's preaching and the guy falls out of the window. I mean, he's preached so long that there's a guy sitting in the window and he falls out. Is it two or three stories? Isn't it three stories? Is it two? At any rate, he falls a long way. He doesn't spend a month in the hospital like Liam did because Paul's able to go out and heal him right then and there. But it was a distraction. There was another time when Jesus is trying to teach and he's got the crowd and you can imagine that they're all very intent and all of a sudden the roof starts caving in. They're like, what is going on? And there's a lot of hustle and bustle and all these things and somebody's actually lowered down through the roof and Jesus has to say, okay, all right, let's focus again. But of course, he didn't have that much difficulty because, you know, he really drew their attention and said, you know, which is easier for me to say, get up and walk or your sins are forgiven. And so my point is simply that distractions happen. We're trying to do the best we can this morning, but, we're trying to work out some things and eventually we'll get the kinks worked out. But it ties in just absolutely perfectly with the things I want to talk about. I have been sharing with you this material is actually a curriculum called The Good and Beautiful God. It's a study that by James Byron Smith that you can go through. I've been working through it with Russell and Joel and Bob Bushman, who comes here, and also one other guy that you haven't met yet. But we've really enjoyed going through it together as a group. And so you can get the full book form if you'd like to, Good and Beautiful God. And I want to share with you kind of the ending of this book. And he does some really neat research into this last chapter. So I'm going to actually read to you a couple of portions from this chapter this time to finish off, because I think you're going to find yourself in this. I'm going to try to do it as quickly as I can. But he opens up, he talks about, one evening my son Jacob and I decided to attend a church concert, and we left our house early so that we could stop at a local coffee shop and get a soda for him and a coffee for me. And over the previous months, he'd been thinking about slowing down to the Savior's, to savor life's moments and to just kind of take in things. And so he said, I was pleased that we had kind of created some margin in our evening together at this coffee shop. He said, once we sat down, we got our drinks and we settled in. And he said, I just kind of started to enjoy the moment, enjoy the atmosphere. But his son, Jacob, chugs down his soda and is like, okay, let's go. And he's like, come on, Dad, let's go. And he says, we've got 15 minutes, he says to his son. Then let's go somewhere else, his son pleads. And he says, why? I want to relax and enjoy my coffee. Come on, please. This is, what did he say? Boring. I've been thinking a lot about American hurry sickness, he says, always being in a rush, and it causes us to be behind in everything. And hurriedness is an inner attitude that is not necessarily caused by outer circumstances. Boredom is one of its symptoms. Boredom is one of the symptoms of hurried sickness. And the solution to the problem is counterintuitive. It goes exactly against what we think it might. Being present where you are is how we can combat hurried sickness. So he says to his son, I'll make you a deal. We can go as soon as you notice five things about this place that you've never noticed before. He had been in the coffee shop a couple of times before, and so he says, what do you mean? And the dad says, all right, well, look around, look at the walls, look at the ceilings, see if you can spy five things that you've never really paid attention to before. So his son looks up in the ceiling, and he says, well, I never noticed that yellow thing up there, and he pointed to an awning that was up there, and his father said, good. Keep on going. So he looked around some more and he says, well, there's an apron hanging on the wall over there. I've never seen that before. Oh, and there's a picture of a dog on that other wall. He says, okay, three down, two more to go. Can you find two more things you've never noticed before? Well, those lamps, there's brown ones. I've never noticed them before. And the floor, it's gray and black. I've never looked at them either. Some of these things you think were pretty obvious. You know, he just never noticed them before. And his father says, you did it, you did it. But then there was this amazing thing. Instead of now wanting to leave right away, his son kept looking around. He's kind of anxious. He's kind of buying into this idea. And he goes on to say, well, maybe it's because I made, you know, a game of it or not. But he says, okay, Jake, you know that your weird dad's always trying to teach you something. So what's the point of this little exercise? And his son pauses for a few seconds and says, stop and notice the world's features. Brilliant, the father says. Why is that important? I guess because the world has a lot of things worth noticing. Even more wisdom. He said, I was so proud of my boy. That's right. He said, and I also wanted to show you that I've been learning the past few months. You see, we get anxious and we say we're bored. But what's really happening is that we aren't paying attention. We aren't living in the present moment. We aren't, and we do that because we think the present moment isn't interesting. But it is. You just discovered that if you stop and notice the world's features, you can stop feeling bored and start enjoying life. Yeah, I get it, Dad. Can we go? I thought that was a good finish to his story. How fast we move. We're so much on the go. We want to have, you know, technology. We want it to work. We want to have things right now. I mean, that's the world we live in. We can relate to that. And hurried sickness, it's not a new thing. Look at this passage in Luke. You remember the story well. Can you flip to that passage? There we go. Jesus and his disciples were on their way, and he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. And you already know what's coming. She had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to what he said. But Martha was distracted by the preparations that had been made, and she came to him and asked, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do work by myself? Tell her to help me. You know the story. Martha is she's distracted by the things that she feels like has to get done. She has this idea, and it's a narrative that we have bought into. And if we're not careful, we can really let it take us away. And that is more. Faster is better. I was interested. This is what I really wanted to share with you more than even that story. I was interested about some of the statistics and some of the ideas that this guy quotes for our need for speed. Listen to this. We are a nation in love with speed. We drive fast. We eat fast. We make love fast. We're obsessed with breaking records and shortening time spans. We digest our life, condense our experiences, and compress our thoughts. I remember when I was in college, I had to write abstracts. Abstracts was to take these big ideas and write them as small as you possibly could. And I would do my best, and I'd turn it into my professor, and she'd turn it back all bleeding red. No, less, 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 shorter, fewer words. And that actually bled over into my wife would try to write papers, and I'd say, no, less, less, too many words, too many words. And then just recently, my wife told me, you have a lot of words. Never thought of myself that way, but I guess I do. We're a culture surrounded by memos and commercials. While other cultures might believe haste makes waste, we're convinced that speed reflects alertness and power and success. Americans are always in a hurry. It's ironic that in a culture so committed to saving time, we feel increasingly deprived of the very thing we value. Isn't that interesting? Despite our alleged efficiency, we seem to have less time for ourselves and far less time for each other. We've quickened the pace of life only to become less patient. We've become more organized but less spontaneous, less joyful. We're better prepared to act on the future but less able to enjoy the present and reflect on the past. Today, we've surrounded ourselves with time-saving technological gadgetry only to be overwhelmed by plans that cannot be carried out, appointments that cannot be honored, schedules that cannot be fulfilled, deadlines that cannot be met. Do you feel that way? Hurried sickness. It started perhaps with the monks. The monks invented clocks. The purpose in inventing the clock, did you know this history? Their purpose was that they invented the clock, and some of the earlier clocks were actually ran on water. But they invented the clock so that they could regulate their day. They believed that to be idle was sinful. that you needed to be working was a way to earn to honor God. And so they created a clock, and they would listen and watch the clock, and they would chime the bell at just the right time so that they would know when it was time to work and when it was time to pray. And they would work very, very hard in order to honor God. But they would also spend 4 to 5 hours a day in prayer, in Lectio Divina. If you remember, we practiced some of that when Joel was leading our class on Wednesday nights. It's just reading a prayer, reading scripture over and over and over again to God as a prayer to God. And they would do that for 4 or 5 times a day. So while they kind of introduced the idea of a clock and introduced the idea of mechanized time over natural time being you wake up with the sun and you go to bed with the sun. You know, wouldn't you love to live that way? My teenagers, they like to be awake when it's dark, as long as it's afternoon, right? You guys like to stay up late. But so that was the beginning of transitioning of time. And then Cologne in Germany, they were the first town to put up this town clock. And the town clock would chime, and boom, when it would chime, it would be time to go to work. And boom, it would be time to go home from work. And that was really the institution or introduction of mechanized time into our society. And it's just kind of compounded from there. And now we live by the clock. How many of you know what time it is right now? Don't know? I'm proud of you. There's a big clock right behind you. Thank you. You honor me by not having looked at it yet. But with the invention of the clock came the invention of the machine, and that may have changed our mentality even more so. This history, I think, is fascinating because it tells us why we have the narrative that we have. When the machine was invented, here was the idea. The machine would work and could work just incessantly, and until it broke down, it was efficient, it would work hard, it didn't tire out, it would just keep on going. And then we saw how well the machine worked, and then suddenly it started to look at man like a machine and started to think, well, man should be just as efficient. Man should work just as unceasingly. And so man started to be considered like a machine. In fact, Frederick Wilson Taylor, he invented what we now deem, he coined the word system. He was working in a steel mill in Philadelphia in the early 20th century. And this is what he did. He had a stopwatch, and he looked at all the different things that needed to be done in the steel manufacturing building in order to get their materials out. And he would time each process and work it down to become as efficient as it possibly could get. And he did. He worked it down. He's like, don't do that. Just do this. And the workers absolutely hated it because they became like machines, and they became very, very efficient. But here's what it says. Do you remember that, Jay? I'm just glancing at you. That was before you. He says, not after, but you've seen, I'm interested because you've seen this change. You've seen the pace of life just quicken and speed up until we're just spiraling. I know you have. This is what he said. Frederick Wilson Taylor, the inventor of the system, said this. In the past, man has been first. In the future, the system must be first. And we see the effects of it when we go in restaurants right now. I mean, you go in restaurants, when we want our meal in 45 seconds or less. You know, if we can be bothered going in, my family doesn't even like to go in. They want to go through the drive-through, you know, and we want to call it in so that when we get to the window, we don't have to hit the brake. We just grab our food and go. You know, I hate the drive-through. But we see it all around us. And here's what's happening with this. What comes with all this activity, this false narrative comes out of this that says you are only as important as what you produce. Can you produce? What are you producing? If you're not producing, if you're not manufacturing, if you're not keeping up, the more you produce, the more value you have. And so we take that on personally. The more I produce, the more value I am. And so the result of that becomes we become overcommitted, we become exhausted, we become burned out, lonely, and we've sacrificed the most important things, like time with God and time with family and emotional and physical health. And then at the end, we have very little to show for it. It's what we talked about this morning with, who was it? You've been measured, you've been weighed. Belshazzar. Belshazzar, thank you. You've been weighed. Everything that you're about, all that you are, all that you own has been put on a scale. And guess what? You've been found wanting. You've missed the boat. God calls us to good work. And so we look at being productive and think, well, that honors God. And it does honor God. But God doesn't call us to be overcommitted. You remember the Jetsons? I love that show. Dun, 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 dun. You know, he'd fly in, and then they had the dog with the funny voice and all that. Cat, what was his name?
Astro.
Astro, that's right. Astro would fly, and he would greet his dad. And it was kind of like the Flintstones on steroids, right? It was the same story, but on the other side. Well, here's something interesting. In 1967, a futurist made a presentation to a subcommittee, a Senate subcommittee, and here's what he said. By 1985, thanks to technology, workers will work 22 hours a week, and they'll only work 27 weeks a year by 1985. That would be your work week, 22 hours a week, but you'd only work 27 weeks a year. And on average, because of technology, by 1985, the average retirement age would be 38 years old. They predicted that we would have too much time on our hands. And the Jetsons show kind of showed that. It was portraying that idea. But in reality, statistics show that since 1973, leisure time has decreased 37%. What happened? We have all these time-saving devices, all these things that can make our communication so simple and quick and instantaneous. Instead of creating more leisure time, all it's done is raised expectations. I think about this a lot. I am now, and some of you have heard me talk about this, I am now expected to be able to be in contact and maintain relationship with not hundreds of people, potentially thousands of people. We were at the workshop, and it was a packed house when Phil Robertson came. And all around me, you know what was going on? People were taking their phones, taking all these selfies, because they wanted everyone in the world to potentially know that they were there to see Phil Robertson. Everybody needed to know. We have this technology has just increased our expectation of productivity, of connectivity, all of these things. People expect that if you send a text, you should receive it and read it immediately. And why aren't they responding? Come on, why aren't you responding? Why aren't you picking up your phone? I mean, is that not the world we live in? Instead of our technology being an assistance to us in creating leisure time, what it's done is it's heightened expectation. It's raised expectations. And so here's another kind of interesting thing that he talks about in his book about time. He says, here's how we spend the light. John Milton says, I consider my light is spent, meaning the light of my life, which is exactly what Jim was talking about this morning. He says this. In the space of our lifetime, today's average person spends 6 months sitting at traffic lights, 8 months opening junk mail, 1 year searching through desk clutter. Some of you are more than that. 2 years trying to call people who are not in, 3 years in meetings, 5 years, some of you they've actually lasted that long, 5 years waiting in line. In a single day, an average American will commute 45 minutes, be interrupted 73 times, and some of you more than that, receive 600 advertising messages, and watch 4 hours of television. The average working parent spends twice as long dealing with email as playing with his or her children. There's a book written, The Praise of Slowness, and the writer says this. There's a book entitled 1 Minute Bedtime Stories, and it came to be phrased to help parents deal with time-consuming tots. Various authors have condensed classic fairy tales into 60-second sound bites. That's the world we live in. 1 Minute Bedtime Stories. The narrative is somehow more is more, faster is better. That's the narrative that we would buy into. But if we keep reading the story, Evan, can we keep reading the story? Let's go back to Mary and Martha. Martha, Martha, the Lord answered, you're worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed. Indeed, only one. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. What is that one thing? There was a movie, City Slickers. Do you remember that movie? Years ago. The main character is he goes out to this ranch, this dude ranch. He's trying to find the meaning of life, and this rancher, he knows. What was the actor's name? I forget it. Jack Palance, there you go. And he says it comes down to one thing. He's just about to tell him, and he kills over dead. Tell me the one thing. What's the one thing? What's the one thing? What does Jesus say? It's listening to him. That's the one thing. That's the one thing that's most important, listening to him. Look at how Jesus spent his life. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him, and when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." Jesus replied, "Let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I have come." So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogue and driving out demons. It's very interesting that it's very early in the morning. Jesus makes sure that he has time for solitude, for silence, for time with Abba. He wants to have time with Abba before he has time in action. Because that's where he finds his identity. That's where he finds his purpose. That's where he finds his direction and his plans. Jesus sets a rhythm for life. He demonstrates a rhythm for life. It's time with God. It's time before God. That's one thing. Just time with God is the one thing that can set everything else in place. But here's what happens. Often what happens is we get so hurried and so anxious that the very things that are most important are the very first things to go. We sacrifice sacred time with God because, well, church has got to go. I got too many other things to do. It's the very thing that goes. Well, I gotta make this happen. I don't have time. And so we sacrifice relationships. The most important things. Russell told me when we were looking at this material, he told me the one thing that minister, or maybe it was a mortician, the guy who runs the funeral home, I don't remember. It was one of these people who sees death a lot. And he says, in all the years I've been doing this, there's one question I've never heard asked on a deathbed. And that is, can I have my golf clubs? He said, I've never heard that asked. But we sacrifice the important things so quickly. But Jesus sets a rhythm here. It's interesting to compare Jesus with the other disciples because the other disciples who are kind of actually new to this game, but they've got all this momentum and they're so excited about all the things they have to do. They're like, Jesus, Jesus, everybody's looking for you. Where have you been? Jesus doesn't even address that. He's like, it's time to go. While they're panicking, he's got this peace about him. He says, let's go. It's time for us to move on and be about the Lord's work. But he finds his center. Because he doesn't let hurried sickness run away with him. We know these things. This is a great cultural battle for us. How do we keep things reined in? How do we keep things in their proper place? Jesus says, look, God is waiting. He's waiting for us. He has plans. But you got to stay rooted in him. This God who is fighting for us. I mean, if all of this is true. You remember John Ortberg? John Ortberg is the guy who wrote the curriculum, The Me I Want to Be, that we did a couple of years ago. John Ortberg was hired at a new place, and he was kind of nervous, and he looked to one of his mentors, Dallas Willard, and he says, Dallas, tell me how I can succeed. Tell me what I need to do. And he got his pen and paper out, and he was ready to write down all these things that Dallas would say to him. And Dallas Willard said this. Dallas Willard said, ruthlessly eliminate hurry. Calm down. Ruthlessly eliminate hurry. I asked my wife just last night, what would it be like if I really cut out everything that wasn't important? Just go through the process of listing everything that I'm involved in, everything that I'm doing. Rearrange those things and say, okay, this is how much time I actually have. And I take all the things I do and pull, okay, I've got time for that, I've got time for that, I've got time for that. I don't have time for the rest. Would you be willing to go through that process? It's something I'm going to have to do. Because I feel the effects of hurried sickness. I really do. I feel tired. I feel burned out. Sometimes I feel lonely. All those things that are mentioned in there, I've experienced that. And you may be like me. You have a desire to be useful to God. And maybe you've got a lot of things you can do. I mean, God doesn't make junk. We've heard that. We all have a lot of talents. Yes, God, I can do more. I can do more. Well, maybe God is saying, but here's the thing. I don't want you to sacrifice the most important things. So I'll leave you with this idea. Pickle yourself. So what does that mean? I learned, my wife's taught me the process of pickling. I didn't know anything about it before. I don't even eat pickles. But maybe I can become a pickle for God. You know, if you were to take a cucumber and you take your little pickle solution, your brine and your vinegar and add all that stuff in there, if you were to take a cucumber and just kind of baptize it in there and pull it right back out again, all it is a wet cucumber. But it takes, you know, a good 6 weeks or so to put that cucumber in there and just let it sit and let that substance, that solution really work its magic. That's how we got to be before God. A student asked a president at a university, he says, you know, can I not just take the shorter course? I mean, got all these, isn't there like a shorter version of this? And the president said, oh yeah, there's a shorter course. It just depends on who you want to be. He said, you know, when God makes an oak, it takes hundreds of years, but it only takes 6 weeks or 6 months to make a squash. So it just depends. And the other thing about oaks is they don't grow all at once. To grow a mighty oak, there's really only about 2 months of growth and 10 months of solidifying that growth. So our own growth, as we kind of based in God and really slow down to let Him do His work, we're going to have periods where we're going to explode and grow in knowledge and understanding and depth of insight and productiveness and all these kinds of things. But there's going to be a long periods of time when God just wants to solidify that growth and let that happen. God is so in love with us and has so much work to do. Paul says to the Philippians, I'm convinced he's going to bring that work to completion. But he's waiting to let us, to give him the opportunity. And it's going to take weeding some things out. Imagine with me, though, imagine if we really got that right. I mean, imagine if we were a body that was really kind of focused on this idea of I only want to have in my life the things that are most important, the things that are going to enrich me the most with God, and cut away and say no to the other things. It's going to take a lot of prayer. It's going to take a lot of that time early in the morning or whatever it's going to be where we get away from everything so that when we come back and the world is hurried all around us and so impatient and so upset and so distraught, we'll be able to step into that world with a calmness and a peace and say, let's go. I know where to go. I know what we're doing because God's shown me. But in order to do that, we have to say no to some things so that we can be saying yes to God. We're going to start on Wednesday night looking at prayer and some of the obstacles of prayer and trying to grow an accountability of prayer. There's a Philip Yancey material we're going to work through. I think it'll be a blessing to you. So I offer that to you as an opportunity to kind of grow in your time with God. Here's what I want you to understand. God is waiting. He's waiting for you. He's got great works. We just can't run ahead of him. Let's pray together.